the temple of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and worshipped Asherah poles and idols. Because of their guilt, God's anger came upon Judah and Jerusalem. Although the Lord sent prophets to the people to bring them back to him, and though they testified against them, they would not listen. Then the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, son of Jehoiada, the priest. He stood before the people and said, "This is what God says. Why do you disobey the Lord's commands? You will not prosper. Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you." But they plotted against him, that is, against Zechariah, and by order of the king, they stoned him to death in the courtyard of the Lord's temple. King Joash did not remember the kindness Zechariah's father Jehoiada had shown him, but killed his son, who said as he lay dying, "May the Lord see this and call you to account." At the turn of the year, the army of Aram marched against Joash. It invaded Judah and Jerusalem and killed all the leaders of the people. They sent all the plunder to their king in Damascus. Although the Aramean army had come with only a few men, the Lord delivered into their hands a much larger army. Because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers, judgment was executed on Joash. When the Arameans withdrew, they left Joash severely wounded. His officials conspired against him for murdering the son of Jehoiada the priest, and they killed him in his bed. So he died and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tomb of the kings. Those who conspired against him were Zabad, a son of Shimeath, an Ammonite woman, and Jehozabad, son of Shimrith, a Moabite woman. The account of his sons, the many prophecies about him, and the record of the restoration of the temple of God are written in the annotations on the book of the Kings. And Amaziah, his son, succeeded him as king. So we'll look. Oh, I will say before we start, bring greetings, of course, from Calvary. It's good to be back here. Thank you for your invitation, and we bring greetings from Calvary Church in Brighton. So let's look into the life of Joash, one of the ones on your chart who is coded in yellow, which I think it means started all right, but didn't do so well later. How many people that's true of? I'm sure many of us could produce a list of people we know who started on the Christian life so well, but didn't keep going. Anyway, to understand the story of Joash, you've really got to look back to the previous two chapters. Read it on your own if you have time. It's well worth reading. I tell you, you don't need Game of Thrones if you've got the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. In fact, I sometimes think it's where George Martin must have got the idea from. They were a thoroughly murderous lot, and they were all interrelated. I tried to put up on the chart there, on the slide, some of the relations between them. I don't know if there's an actual pointer here. No, not going to point, never mind. I've tried to colour them by the royal families that they belonged to. For the women, I've coloured them in the colours of the families they were born into, rather than the ones they married into, because it just shows how they were all interrelated and how, as I say, what a murderous lot they were on the whole. So in chapter 22, Athaliah, who was the daughter of the notorious Queen Jezebel of the northern kingdom of Israel, and it was very much like mother, like daughter. She had put her son, Ahaziah, on the throne of Judah. But at this time, of course, there was a civil war going on in the northern kingdom in Israel, and Ahaziah made the mistake of visiting his uncle, Joram, king of Israel. It's really the same name, Jehoram again, but the translators help us a bit by calling the Judean king Jehoram and the Israelite king Joram. But Ahaziah made the mistake of going to visit his uncle, perhaps seeking an alliance. But instead, he got himself caught up in the civil war and got himself killed by Jehu, who was in the business of, pretty well exterminating the family of Jezebel. So there's a power vacuum now, not only in civil war in the north, but now in Judah, there's a power vacuum. And Athaliah, the queen, or the queen mother, as she was, proceeds to seize power for herself. And she tries to assassinate all the male members of the royal family, many of whom were her own grandsons, of course. You say you couldn't make this stuff up, but we almost wouldn't believe it. We don't know from other records of the time. That's exactly what these people used to do. They would exterminate other members of their own family who could be rivals for the throne. And Athaliah tries to do exactly that, kill her, all the royal princes, including some who would have been her own grandsons. But one of them survives. And Joash, a baby at the time, about 1 year old, is rescued by his aunt. His aunt is Jehosheba, who also survives the purge, probably because she was married to the priest Jehoiada. Jehoiada's name was the Lord Knows, and what an appropriate name that was of what was going on at the time. Jehosheba was, as I say, was a daughter of King Jehoram, either a sister or possibly a half-sister, it's not entirely clear, of King Ahaziah, the one who was killed. But she manages to rescue one of the royal princes, and that's Joash, smuggles him into the temple of the Lord, and with her husband Jehoiada the priest, they hide Joash in the temple for 6 years, while Athaliah clings on to power in Judah. Of course, the palace and the temple are very close, but such is the situation and the power struggles that are going on in the city that apparently they were able to hide Joash for 6 years. And then when Joash is 7 years old, Jehoiada carries out an absolutely brilliantly planned and executed coup. We read the story of that in chapter 23. He has the support largely of the population. He has the support, as we read it, of at least some of the army. And he has the support, of course, his own support as the Levites and the temple guard. And between them, they guard the temple. They occupy the city and send a detachment to the palace. And they bring out Joash to proclaim him king. In the chaos, Athaliah, Athaliah the queen is captured and is killed by Jehoiada's soldiers. And so Jehoiada has Joash proclaimed king. I say it all makes the War of the Roses look like a polite family argument, doesn't it? They're all, as you can see from the slide there, all completely interrelated, all married into each other's family, and yet they seem to spend most of their time trying to get rid of each other. But of course, it's not just a political struggle that's going on here. Behind all this is not just a struggle for political power, but a struggle between the followers of Yahweh, of the Lord, the God of Judah, and the followers of the Canaanite deities, Baal and Asherah. And politics and religion are, of course, intimately related in Judah at the time. And it's a struggle as much, not in the political arena, as in the spiritual arena, the religious arena, between the followers of the Lord and the followers of the Canaanite religions of their neighbor, the neighbors of the country. I made this work. Yes, good. So Joash is proclaimed king. But of course, he's only 7 years old. His name means given by the Lord, and he was the eighth king of Judah. And he reigned, we are told, for 40 years. And initially, there was a period of respite from civil war in the southern kingdom and a certain amount of peace. But of course, behind this, the real power behind the throne, of course, is the high priest Jehoiada, uncle by marriage to Joash, and who, it appears, effectively has control of the army as well. And it's the chronicler rather wryly points out, you may have noticed this in chapter 24, verse 6, that when Joash did actually have an idea of his own, when he decided to restore the temple of the Lord, said, do it at once, but nobody took any notice until he actually got Jehoiada on side. And then, of course, the plan to restore the temple went ahead. I think the chronicler is gently hinting to us there that the real power in the land was held, of course, by Jehoiada. It seems that some of Joash's uncles had robbed the temple and the resources were needed to restore it. And so a tax is declared. Generally, a new tax leads to protest, doesn't it? But this tax seems actually to have been rather popular. There seems to have been a lot of popular support for restoring the temple. And so the people, we notice, contribute gladly in verse 10. A proper financial control is introduced in verse 11. And actually, they land up with more money than they know what to do with. So initially, the cash is spent on rebuilding the temple in verses 12 to 14. But actually, if you look at the parallel passage in 2 Kings, you find that a lot of it goes into the coffers of the king, and it was in fact used to buy off various attackers, probably including the Aramaeans that are mentioned in this passage. So while Jehoiada is still alive, as we're told, there was a period of peace, a period of popular support for the king, and a period of restoring the temple. And things seemed to be going well until Jehoiada dies. But Jehoiada has not resorted to the gruesome tactics of Judah's neighbours. True that Athaliah and the high priest of Baal have been executed, but Jehoiada had carried out no bloody purge of his enemies. Jehoiada has popular support, and it seems that there was some respect for the dislike of unnecessary bloodshed, which was just the way they did things in the surrounding kingdoms. So Jehoiada dies. And once again, there's a power vacuum. What will happen? Joash himself, of course, although he's been king for a long time now, is really unused to effective action. But now he has to take control in the crisis. So which way will he jump? Will he enlist the support of his cousin and effectively brother, Zechariah? Or will the instincts of his bloody family assert themselves? And regrettably, the latter turns out to be the case. Joash listens to the flattery of the advocates of the old regime. That seems to be what it means in chapter 24, verse 17. It says just the officials of Judah, but which officials of Judah? Presumably they want the supporters of the old regime. Likely their motivation is as much political as it's religious, but Judah needs friends. And by legalizing the Canaanite religion again, in verse 18, alliances can be formed by marriage or other diplomatic means. And perhaps that's what Joash had in mind. But whatever he was thinking, the result is a disaster. A new struggle for political control ensues. And the Lord sends prophets to call the people of Jerusalem back to the Lord and the temple worship. But it seems they're ignored. And finally, in a sort of resonance that resonates through the Bible, it's the son, Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, who stands up as the prophet, say the one who really is a cousin, literally, and effectively the brother of Joash the king. And the Spirit prompts Zechariah to stand up. Surely the king will not have his own cousin executed. And yet he does. Joash returns to the murderous ways of his grandmother. And Zechariah, whose name means the Lord remembers, again another rather appropriate name, Zechariah is killed, stoned, at the instigation of Joash. Again, perhaps he thought that that if Zechariah spoke, then Joash would remember the kindness of his father Jehoiada, who had effectively saved and adopted Joash, but that was not the case. Joash is killed, and we have his dying words recorded. Zechariah, whose name, as I say, means the Lord remembers, calls on the Lord to remember and to call Joash to account. Now it seems the Lord does not delay long in answering that dying prayer. Aram, by this time, is a fading power, is suggested by the fact that they could only field a small raiding party, a small army. Aram is threatened by more powerful neighbours to the north and the east. They're in desperate need of some resources and some victories. Israel, as I say, is more or less in a state of civil war to the north. They're not in a position to hold off the Aramaeans. And so the Aramaeans launch what would seem to be rather a forlorn attack on Judah. But in spite of the fact that Judah had greater numbers in the army, Judah is defeated, verses 23 and 24. And Joash's remaining financial resources are plundered. And indeed, it seems from the parallel passage in 2 Kings that much of the money that had been collected for restoring the temple was perhaps used to buy off the Aramaeans and the other attackers. In the battle, Joash himself is wounded. And finally, it seems the people have had enough. Again, he's murdered in a palace coup. And the chronicler, that the writer of 2 Chronicles, who seems to like these little ironic details, tells us something that's not in the 2 Kings account, actually. But the two assassins who murder Joash, who purportedly are avenging Zechariah, who was a true Israelite and Levite, but actually these two assassins are actually sons of Canaanite women. So much is the political mess in Judah of shifting alliances, of no one knowing who to trust. Judah is once again in chaos. Well, as it says in the last verse, there is a son, Amaziah succeeds Joash, and you'll be looking presumably later at what happened. But what are some reflections we can make of this extraordinary story? And I suppose we would have to say that the real heroes of this story are not Joash, of course, but Jehoiada and then his son Zechariah. Same family, and they had similar aims. But it might be interesting to reflect a little on their different methods. Jehoiada seems to have been a political genius. And he attempted to reform Judah by political and military power. And on the face of it, for a while, he was successful. After an absolutely brilliantly executed coup, he suppressed the worship of Baal and Asherah. He restored the temple and he protected the rightful king. Joash should have been king anyway, of course. He was the son of the previous king. But in nurturing that young king, we find that ultimately Jehoiada failed. Because he failed, didn't he, to win over the heart and mind of Joash to the service of the Lord. If he'd done that, if he'd managed to do that, then that would have been his real legacy. But he failed to do that, in spite of having brought up the child from a baby, in spite of having supported him as king from the age of 7. He failed to win over the heart and mind of Joash. Of course, it's tempting to speculate, isn't it, what really was going on. Did Joash secretly resent Jehoiada's power? Did he just feel that he'd been just a puppet king and had wanted to reassert his own policies? Or was it simply that he was easily led astray, that having not really been in a position of rule, he just didn't know who to listen to? We don't know for certain what Joash's motivations were. But what we do know is that that mere outward conformance to the temple worship wasn't enough. We find that Joash's heart was not in it. And in spite of the terrible example of his grandmother, in spite of the civil war going on in the northern kingdom, he didn't really believe that the soul and prosperity of the nation was to be found in the temple worshipped. While it was politically expedient to support the temple, Joash would do it. But when the political wind changed, Joash would bend to it. And so Joash delivered the land back to divine anger and political chaos. The methods of his grandmother and great-grandmother took over. Assassination became a political tool again. And of course, the result was what you expect. Those who live by the sword die by the sword. Those who live by the assassin's knife die by the assassin's knife. Soon that would lead to his own destruction. And where there's no integrity and trust within the political system, anything becomes legitimate, doesn't it? It's just make sure you spin it right. It's all a matter of having the right spin doctors. Well, Joash failed to have the right spin doctors. He didn't even get himself buried in the tomb of the kings. So we might consider and contrast Zechariah with his father. He attempted no military coup. He, as far as we know, made no attempt to control the army. Whether this was by choice or necessity, we don't know. What did Zechariah have instead? Well, we're told in verse 20, what Zechariah had instead was the Spirit of the Lord. In a sense, his weapons were just words. He didn't resort to military power. He didn't resort to assassination. He resorted to the words of the Spirit and to prayer. And on the face of it, you have to say he failed. Certainly his words led to his death. And yet his dying words were not unanswered, were they? His dying prayer was not unanswered. Joash was indeed judged by the Lord. And in fact, for a time, the spirit of the nation is preserved as we go on through the kings of Judah. We find it wasn't all bad news by any means. There were some good kings to follow. So, in a sense, the judgment of Joash, the message of Zechariah, did have some effect. And at a time of political unrest and political chaos in our own land, it's worth remembering we've not yet reached the state where we resort to assassination, at least not among the corridors of power anyway, although I say we have terrorist attacks. But you can't impose love for God by force. It can't be done. Politics cannot really result in good religion, but the converse is certainly true. It's by the fear of the Lord, by wisdom, that kings rule. And the fear of the Lord is the foundation of good politics. And when the state has no religious anchor, everything goes. Anything goes. Might take a while to drift, but eventually corruption takes over. And it's likely that the violence won't be that long after that. It's been said that it's a short step from burning books to burning people. And we thank God that we've not yet reached that situation in our land. Yet, we're moving in some ways in that direction with the suppression of free speech, with the suppression of, with the increasing power of the military for necessary reasons. I can't say one could say they're wrong in having the army on the street in the last week. It was probably necessary to do that. But it's a step, isn't it, in a bad direction in one sense. The real battle is not for political control. Somehow it seems that terrorists seem to understand this better than our leaders do. The real battle is for the hearts and minds of men and women. And so it's Zechariah, isn't it, not Jehoiada, whose life points us towards the Prince of Peace, whose life points us towards the true origins of peace. Like Zechariah, the Lord Jesus made no attempt at a political revolution. That was what his followers expected. But like Zechariah, he didn't go down that route. Instead, he said, his kingdom is not of this world. He didn't attempt to restore the political power of Judah. Instead, he said, his kingdom was for the hearts and minds of men and women, as those verses that we read earlier. That's what the law is really about, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind and with all your strength and your neighbour as yourself. But there are other parallels between the life of Jesus and the life of Zechariah. Jesus was empowered by the Spirit of God when the Spirit came on him after his baptism, we were told. And like Zechariah, his proclaiming of the words of the Lord through the Spirit of the Lord led to his death. Jesus, like Zechariah, was faithful to death. But there's a difference as well, isn't there? Because Zechariah's dying words, Zechariah's dying prayer, called for God's justice. He called for God's judgment on those who had killed him. We also know what Jesus' dying prayer was. And we know that it was for the forgiveness of those who were putting him to death. Zechariah's death preserved the nation for a few more generations, as his dying prayer led to the death of Joash. But ultimately, Zechariah's death did not have the power to deflect God's wrath and judgment. But in the death of Jesus Christ, we find that there is true salvation, true righteousness, and a peaceful kingdom to be found. A kingdom that rules in the hearts and minds, not by political violence, but by calling people truly to love the Lord. So it's worth meditating on that at our time, as I say, of political unrest. The true hope for the kingdom is the words of the Spirit of the Lord to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that only in the words of Jesus and the life of Jesus and the death and resurrection of Jesus is true hope for the kingdom to be found.